A little while ago, I was listening to a literature professor, and he said that once he was a guest speaker at a university on the West Coast, and he went to the restroom, and they have those things to, you push the button to dry your hands, to blow dry your hands. And he said on the button that you would push, somebody had put a little sticker, and it said, "For a sample of one of the dean's lectures, push this button." And so I hope that that's not the reaction that everybody is having to this series of lectures. But anyway, we left off last time with this question. What is the basis for human responsibility? So we have attempted to solve the problem of evil. That absolves God of responsibility, but then we have to also answer the question, what is the foundation for human responsibility? In a completely predetermined world, how is God just in holding people responsible? So we have to uphold human guilt at the same time as maintaining the justice of God. So I just want to do a little bit of review to kind of establish where we've been, because what I'm going to suggest today builds on what we have been talking about so far. So there are two things that I believe that I've already proved in this series. The first is that God causes evil, and I would submit that there's no doubt that the Bible teaches God causes evil. That immediately raises the problem of evil to the forefront of our minds, because if God is causing evil, how is it that he's not culpable for it? How is it that he's not guilty of evil himself? And so that brings us to the second point, which is that God is above the law. If, in fact, God is supreme, there can be nothing above him, and that includes law, and that includes some other being to hold God responsible. So this then is the solution to the problem of evil. If there's nothing above God, if God is at the top of the food chain, then the idea of law does not apply to him, and the idea of guilt does not apply to him either. And so we're really asking a bad question if we say, is God guilty? On the basis of those two things, then, we need to also answer the question, how is it in a world where God causes evil, how is it that we are responsible? And so I have this proposal. Guilt before God is ultimately based on God's sovereign choice to hold a man responsible. So, basically, this is to say, if God is above the law and has, in fact, created justice and law and morality, if those are all things that are part of his divine decree, then ultimately, God decides who is guilty and who is not guilty. He may have systems of doing that, but ultimately, it's his prerogative to decide. This is where we're going here in this lesson. Before we really get into that, I want to give a little bit of the plan here going forward. So,
go ahead.
In this lesson, I want to analyze three theories of guilt. So we're going to take a little bit of a step back in this lesson. You saw how the position I'm giving here about how guilt is, it follows directly on what we've already discussed. But I want to take a little step back and say, what are the possible ways that people have looked at guilt and the judicial grounds of human responsibility throughout the years? And in my reading, I've come across basically three. So we're going to take a look at those and see if they're viable or not. In the next lesson, then, we're going to look at justice versus original sin. So any theory of guilt and the judicial grounds of guilt has to account for two big problems in theology, which is, how do we become responsible for Adam's sin, and how is that just? And how does Christ become responsible for our sins, and how is that just? In lesson 7, we're going to take up justice and original sin, and whether original sin is a just thing for God to have done. And then in lesson 8, we're going to take up justice versus atonement, and how is atonement just on the basis of what we've already discussed. And I believe that both of these are just. The Bible says that God is just and the justifier. So at all costs, we have to uphold that God is just. And I believe that what we've already learned in this course gives us the groundwork to understand how this is possible. But this lesson, we're gonna take a look at some historical ways in which the guilt has been thought about. So, three theories of guilt. Number one is that a man is guilty if he chooses freely. So, God can only hold a person responsible if their choices are truly undetermined, if he's not causing their choices. This is, if you believe in free will, this is obviously the position that you're going to take. Secondly, so the Calvinists obviously would reject this position. So what has been the traditional reform view? And that is this. A man is guilty if he has the natural ability to act to the contrary. Now, this is a little bit, we're going to have to take a little bit more time explaining this because it's not as immediately obvious of a distinction going on here. But basically the idea is that man has all the equipment he needs. God has given him all the equipment that he needs. You know, he has a voice box so he can tell the truth or lie, either one, with his same makeup. And so the idea that even though his choices are predetermined by God, he still has this natural ability. He still has all the equipment, and it's on that basis that God can hold men responsible, even though their actions are predetermined. Going to get back to that in more detail, but that's the basic idea. And that has been, to my knowledge, the traditional reform view. If you read an author like A.W. Pink, that's the view you're going to get. Thirdly, the view that I'm going to be arguing for here is that a man is guilty for whatever God decides to make him guilty for. So that God does not need any judicial grounds for holding someone responsible. There's no judicial grounds outside of God or anything that is governing God's decision. Since he sets up justice, he can do whatever he wants. So ultimately, the reason why we're responsible is just because God has decided to hold us responsible for a certain action. This is not to say that he doesn't have principles or systems that he works by, but ultimately, if we're going to find an explanation for why somebody is guilty and on what basis they are guilty, we will not find it outside of the sovereign choice of God. Okay, so let's go through these a little bit. We can reject the first one pretty much out of hand because it rests on a theory of free will that we've already proven to be false. It rests on the idea that a human choice must be indeterminate in order for it to be just for God to hold us responsible. This is clearly not the case, or else no one would be responsible, because no one has free will. No one has choices outside of God's control. So we can reject that one. This next one, though, we need to spend a little more time on. And the first thing to do is to really understand it. This is a little bit technical, but if you stick with me, it's not that far off from what we've already talked about. We've already dealt with these concepts, so this is not new, but we do have some new terms here. So, traditional Reformed theologians have separated the ideas of natural ability and moral ability, such that natural ability is the idea that a man has all the equipment, hands, feet, mind, will, to do both good and evil. So basically, if a man wants to, he can do good or evil. However, moral ability is the idea that if a man has moral ability, a man's motivations do not control him completely, such that he really can choose good or evil. So the idea of this moral ability is that a man's psychology or God's will, neither of those things completely predetermine his decisions. So Calvinism believes in the idea of total depravity, such that a sinful man, an unregenerate man, cannot choose to do a good action. This moral ability would be the idea that a totally depraved, or if you accept moral ability, you don't accept total depravity, but it would be the idea that a sinful man really can choose good sometimes, and it's entirely possible that he could do that. Total depravity would say that he can't. Moral ability is basically to say free will exists. Free will is the idea that man's decisions are indeterminate. He really can choose good or evil in any given situation. And so if you say that justice rests on free will or moral ability, then you're saying, you're taking that that first position, that free will is the grounds of justice. However, what Reformed theologians have done is said, okay, we know man doesn't have moral ability, but that doesn't mean he doesn't have a certain kind of ability. And that ability is called natural ability, such that he still has all the equipment. You know, if he wanted to, maybe he never wants to, but if he did, he could do it. And it's on that basis, the basis that he has all the equipment, that God is able to justly hold a man responsible for his actions. This makes a lot of intuitive sense. You know, if you are quadriplegic in a wheelchair and you see someone drowning in a lake, and you're of course not going to be able to rescue them, but you're not responsible for that, not being able to rescue them, because you had no natural ability to do it, right? So this makes quite a bit of intuitive sense. Isn't natural ability in some way the basis for guilt? Is this distinction clear? Because if you don't understand this, it's not really going to make sense. What am I going to say next?
Well, one of the examples you put up there for natural ability is will.
Right. So the what someone like Pink would say is you have a will, and the will, even though it is determined, has the natural ability to go either way in terms of its nature itself, even though it's predetermined. Now, you're right. It gets a little confusing when you start talking about if the nature of the will is totally depraved, how can it have the natural ability to do good? And I think there's some definitional issues there, but this is basically the way it's thought about.
Question is the natural ability, is there natural ability in the redeemed as well as the unredeemed? Or is there a difference in the natural ability in this definitional scheme?
I think in terms of the traditional scheme here, it would say that nobody has moral ability, everybody has natural ability. When you're a totally depraved sinner, you have no moral ability to do good. When you become regenerated, you start to have the ability. You now have your morality, if you want to say it that way, is changed such that now sometimes the good morality wins out and sometimes the bad morality wins out, but you're still controlled by your psychology. Does that make sense? Your psychology has changed, so what you do changes. This is in the Reform view.
Traditional Reform.
Yep. What we're looking at here is a traditional Reform position. So they would still say, even when you do the good action as a regenerate person, you still had the natural ability to do the evil action, even though you didn't have the moral ability to do the evil action. So it would be on the same basis that a good action is meritorious, because we had the natural ability to do the opposite.
And for the unredeemed, there's no meritorious behavior, even if through common grace they do a good act.
Right. I mean, it would be good only in a subsidiary sense, or it's not good with respect to God. It has no merit to God. It may have merit before other humans, but you know, all our righteousness is as filthy rags. So God doesn't look upon it as meritorious in any sense. I think, to my knowledge, that it would be the traditional Reform view. So the question becomes, is this a sufficient explanation for a judicial grounds of guilt? Is this a sufficient explanation? And it works to a certain extent, but I believe it has some fatal flaws. I have one slide here I forgot. This is the traditional Reform view. Even when he is morally unable to do good, a man is responsible for his sin because he has the natural ability or the equipment to do righteousness. So this works to a certain extent, but I think it has a fatal flaw, or a couple of fatal flaws. And here's the first one. Christ became guilty for sins without the natural ability to act to the contrary. So this is basically just to say that Christ is not us. If you're not, Christ does not have the natural ability to do Conrad's sin because, or to not do Conrad's sin because he's not Conrad. He lived 2,000 years ago. There's no natural ability or disability. There's no ability at all going on. So I would submit that the theory of natural ability can give no explanation for the justice of a transfer of guilt. We have the reverse problem. The elect receive the merit of Christ's actions without the natural ability to do or not do them. So again, Christ lived 2,000 years ago. I receive the merit of his actions applied to me, and yet I have no natural ability to do or not do what Christ did. And so we seem to have a this theory seems to have a great limitation here. Yes.
Aren't we talking about now atonement here and substitutionary atonement? But why is that a fatal flaw in natural ability regarding an individual's guilt?
What we need here is a judicial grounds of guilt that applies in all situations where there are guilt. Otherwise, we have not found the fundamental reason why people are guilty. If a theory of guilt cannot explain how Christ became really and truly guilty for our sins, then it's not a complete understanding of what, or a basic understanding of what guilt, of the basis upon which guilt can be justly imputed to somebody.
The justice requires that the same justice apply to Christ as applies to man.
Right. If there is one universal just meaning to justice, then we must have an explanation, one single explanation for all. And natural ability claims to be that explanation. So then one final flaw. We also have the case of Adam and us, and this is perhaps the most fatal of all. All men become guilty for Adam's sin when they have no natural ability to act to the contrary. I become guilty for eating the fruit in the garden, and yet I was never there. I never had the opportunity to not eat the fruit. So how is it just for me to be held responsible? You see, natural ability as being the basis for justice doesn't make sense here at all. We have to find something else. You might say Reformed theologians are a pretty intelligent group of people. Haven't they realized that there's this problem? Well, the answer is yes, they have, and there's been a number of attempts to explain transfer of guilt in light of a theory of natural ability. And most of them have been in the case of atonement, and here's what they are. The first is, so this is an attempt to explain how it's just for guilt to be transferred between individuals, when we still accept that ability in the person is in some way the grounds of guilt. Okay, so what they will say is, Christ freely chose to take our guilt. So it was a voluntary thing of Christ, and therefore it's okay, even though it's not normally just for a judge to just transfer guilt between people. It's okay because we have a voluntary substitute. So here you can see this idea of free will starting to creep back in, right? It's okay if it's free. So I have an issue with this theory on that level, in that it introduces free will as the basis for guilt. But even aside from that, there's a bigger problem here. Let's say that this can explain atonement, which I don't believe it can, but let's say that it could. You have a bigger problem with regard to Adam and us, because even if Christ freely took our sin, we did not freely take Adam's sin. At least I didn't. I know for a fact I never agreed to take Adam's sin, and if I had an opportunity, I would not. I would definitely not agree. So even if a freedom, a voluntary substitution, can explain atonement, it can't explain original sin. So we're back to the same problem. What's another idea? Here's another thing that's been proposed. This was most popularly, I believe, proposed by John Owen. Christ and believers have a mystical union. So the idea is, he says, this is practically a quote from him, Christ and believers coalesce into one mystical person. And in doing so, because they become that one mystical person, they have this unity, and it's entirely unique unity, it's possible for guilt to be transferred between them, even though it's not possible in any other case. I think there are a lot of problems with this. Mainly, I do not believe that the Bible teaches a mystical union between Christ and believers. I think his proofs of that are inadequate. I have. If anyone would like to delve into that subject, I have written a detailed criticism of him on that subject. But I don't. It's all that aside. I don't believe it works out in the details. I don't believe he can explain what this mystical union is and how it is the basis for guilt transfer. Even if he could, and even if it did explain atonement, you still again have this problem of Adam. Even if we do have this union with Christ, we don't have a union with Adam. There is no mystical union with Adam in the Bible. That we can know for sure. So the only really union we have with Adam is the fact that we get his sin. So it cannot explain that phenomenon. Even if you accept that a mystical union explains the transfer of guilt, which I don't accept, by the way, it still does not explain the case of Adam because we have no mystical union with Adam. So, to my knowledge, these are the theories that have been put forward. I don't know of any others. There may be others. Maybe some of you know of some. But these are the ideas, to my knowledge, that have been put forward in terms of how guilt can be transferred between individuals. If these have failed, then natural ability as an explanation, as a fundamental explanation for how guilt can be attached to a particular person, has failed also. We have to have a different idea of how this works, of what is the grounds for justice. So my conclusion is, traditional Calvinism has failed to explain the justice of atonement and original sin because it has refused to discard freedom and ability as fundamental to guilt. So Calvinists have said, even though, sure, we don't have this moral ability or moral freedom, surely we still have some sort of ability or freedom, and this natural ability or freedom, which is still surely the grounds of guilt. We see how it just doesn't work out. It's not consistent with the Bible's teaching. So we must reject freedom or guilt, freedom or ability in the human as fundamental to culpability or guilt. So then, the first two theories fail, and then I have a proposal to make. And that is this. Guilt before God is ultimately based on God's sovereign choice to hold a man responsible. And you see, if you take this, everything becomes clear. If God can do whatever he wants to do, then he can transfer guilt if he wants to transfer guilt. He doesn't need some external judicial basis for his decision. Just his decision, I'm going to hold you responsible, is good enough. Now, normally, apparently, he holds people responsible for the actions that they do themselves. And that's fine and good. But in two particular cases, he decided not to do that, and that would be in Adam's transfer to us and in our transfer to Christ. And that's okay if you believe that the ultimate basis of guilt is God's sovereign choice to hold someone responsible. It explains all cases, and I don't know of any other theory that does. And it furthermore builds off of everything we've been talking about. The idea that law is a creation of God, that morality is part of his decrees, not part of his nature or above him governing him, then this must be the case, that justice is ultimately grounded in his decree, not in something else. So that concludes my ideas for today.
Well, the verse that came to my mind that I think appears on the surface, at least to me, without doing any study, to go along with that would be, he visits this iniquity to the third or to a thousand generations, third or fourth generation. And then, isn't that the same type of thing where he's holding them, the third and fourth generations, guilty for something that they hadn't?
Right, so are you saying that agrees or disagrees with what I'm saying?
It sounds to me like it agrees.
Yeah.
And the same thing when he punished the whole guy's family and everybody else for the sin there, or, you know, in the water, swallow them all up. Different cases in the scripture, it seems like you have people that are completely away from the action. It's always been a bother to me. Mm-hmm. Why are they getting thrown in with the guilty when they had nothing to do, it seems to me, on the least according to the reading, with that man's sin?
Yeah, it's bothered me too. But if you believe that God fundamentally can do whatever he wants to do, then it really doesn't pose an issue. The only issue that you would have is that if God said he was always going to do it in one particular way, and then he doesn't do it that way, then you have a problem. But I don't believe that he's ever said that he is going to do it only in one particular way.
I walked in a little late, mm-hmm. so maybe this was addressed. Are you saying that we are... Are you going with some of the new reform stuff that's going on out there with reparations, and you have to make reparations for you know, because your family was slaveholders, you know, stuff like that? Is that what you're?
I know very little about that controversy. I don't think I've read anything too much on this subject from past the last century. So. So you're saying the idea is that since the iniquity of the fathers passes on, that we have to make reparations for what our parents did? I mean, you could, I guess, make that argument. I don't. It's not a deduction from what I'm saying. All I'm saying is, what is the basis for God holding somebody responsible? If God has said that the children must make restitution for the sins of their fathers, then that is certainly true. If he hasn't said that, then it's certainly not true. I would tend to think that he hasn't said that, but I don't see...
He's actually said the opposite.
Yeah. Where?
The children are not... You know, each man bears his own sin.
Right. The Ezekiel. The fathers ate sour grapes and the children's teeth are set on edge. And then God says... How does it go? The soul that sinneth, it shall die.
Addresses of verses.
Yeah.
But I know that there's a verse that says each man bears his own sin. You're proposing here that the Adam's and Christ's The guilt of Adam imputed to mankind, and the guilt of the sinner, the redeemed sinner, imputed to Christ, are both God's sovereign actions, and those are kind of the exceptions.
Mm-hmm. Special cases. Yeah.
The special cases.
Those two.
Mm-hmm. And that the rest of it is absolutely governed by the other examples that we have in the Bible.
I'm not going to go so far as to say that those are the only two, that I know those are the only two special cases. Like Ryan's saying, there does seem to be other places where God holds secondary individuals responsible. Whether those have other explanations, I'm not ready to make an assertion on. And their families. No, you could... I've definitely heard it argued that they were complicit in the action by standing with them. On the other hand, is that sufficient to account for them receiving the same punishment? All I'm saying is this proposal that I'm making explains all cases regardless.
As a people... Mankind needs to have an explanation that they can rest on, where you're not all that worried about a capricious God who will decide at any moment that, okay, you're going to be guilty because of something your grandfather did. Mm-hmm. You know, you'd live in constant fear that...
Well, unless you're redeemed and you know that all your sins, regardless, have been transferred to Christ, then you don't have to be in fear. But if you were an unbeliever, I mean, maybe that fear is not a bad thing entirely. But at the same time, it seems to be the clear teaching of Scripture that fundamentally the soul that sinneth, it shall die, is the general principle of God's justice. If you break the law, you die, just you, you're done. But if you take that as a universal principle of justice, then it is definitely contradictory to the case of Adam, because we are all punished for Adam's first sin. So we have to allow for special cases, and we have to allow for, we have to have a theory that is able to accommodate these special cases.
We have to be able to recognize the special cases.
Right.
But then we have to dig them all out.
In the example of Korah that you're talking about,
yes,
no one was punished that wasn't alive at that time. There wasn't future generations.
Right, true.
Huh?
True, yeah.
There wasn't future generations that were punished because of those sins.
No, but the entire family, you know, including moms and dads and the babies they were holding,
but how is that any different than if I level a false accusation against my brother or I stand beside him complicit in a sin, that the punishment is supposed to be coming back to me?
What about the baby?
I'm with you on that.
Yeah, I mean, that's because that happened with Achan, too, and after Jericho. Remember, he took the wedge of gold and
right.
buried it under his head. Okay.
That's the one that I was thinking of.
Okay, well, there you've got a situation where he buried it under their tent. He couldn't do that in secret. So his family was aware of it, you know? I mean, they had the rugs spread out over top of it, and they buried it, you know? Okay. But the babies didn't know. The kids didn't have any, but the whole family was stoned with stones and then mounted up and left there as a reminder.
In the case of...
So that would support your position?
I think so. I don't know of any other. I don't know of any other explanation that can account for those actions of God. In the case of the iniquity of the fathers, it kind of depends on how you interpret the word iniquity, as to whether you say it's the guilt of the iniquity or like the corruption, the consequences surrounding. Some of those things may be able to be explained under the normal process of justice in the Bible. The important point is to recognize that God can change it if he wants to and make special cases if he wants to. And we can't be the pots answering back to him and saying, you can't do that. Because he just sets it up how he wants to set it up. Yes?
Yeah, one case you may argue a special case, and people will use this to argue against capital punishment, is David. David murdered, committed adultery and murdered, complicit in the murder. He actually gets twice, double, right? Now, God, through Nathan the prophet, gave, in this case, special mercy to David, mm-hmm. and didn't have him put to death, except wasn't mercy. Because by the time it was done, it was really horrible what happened to his family.
Yeah.
And I maintain that David would have had a choice. He might have said, nah, just kill me now. I don't want to see all this happen.
Yeah.
But again, it seems to me that's not an argument against capital punishment, because if God makes special cases, that's his business. We, on the other hand, are clearly being told what we need to do, and that's what we need to do. And we can't hold God responsible for a special case like David, because if he wants to administer justice in a different way than what we think he's supposed to do based on what he's told us, we can't. It seems like we can't do that.
Yeah.
I like that theory better in the woman caught in adultery than, you know, I think I heard you propose that possibly all of those were guilty of the same sin, and it doesn't say that. Yeah, but I think you have a little bit of a challenge with that passage as it's written until you throw in this concept. Then it's.
You're talking about the woman that Jesus talked to? On adultery? Okay.
Wasn't she responsible to be put to death? She was called? She had witnesses?
There were no witnesses.
Oh. Well, they said, didn't they say there were witnesses?
Well, here's the woman caught in adultery. What are you going to do about her? Right?
Right.
And so he says, let he who's
without sin, cast the first stone. And everybody went away. There was no one left to accuse her. So when he looked up from drawing in the dust, there were no accusers.
But the idea of the day, what he said wasn't how we normally treat someone who's guilty. Because if I say someone is guilty, and the judge says, well, only if you're innocent can you... That isn't how we normally come after guilty. You know, I'm not saying I'm innocent of every sin, and
isn't a criminal's testimony a valid testimony?
I'm sorry.
It is a criminal's testimony a valid testimony?
No. I don't have any idea that the woman said anything.
I'm saying...
He said, let him who is not guilty cast the first stone, or whatever.
Isn't how we normally address guilt.
We might use witnesses that were also part of the crime in a normal court situation, right?
Correct.
Yes,
we do. But what I'm saying is that the woman was let go not on a special case, but because the law was strictly complied with.
Two or three witnesses.
There were no witnesses against the woman.
Well, there were originally, and Jesus told him to leave.
He didn't say that.
He said, if you're not guilty, only those who are not guilty. And that is not how the law would read.
Joel.
Let's address that. The question that he asked, the only way we know that she was guilty, the only way we can guess at it is because Christ said, go and sin no more. This was a judicial setting. And remember the question that he asked them, woman, where are your accusers?
Where are your accusers?
And so by the time he said there were no accusers, this was a case, a judicial case. You can only condemn guilt with two or three witnesses. So I maintain she wasn't guilty. She was not judicially guilty.
You mean from in a human court situation?
Absolutely, which is what was being set up. Because that's what they were asking for. They said, Moses said we need a stoner. They're asking for a judicial court here. They had her lined up. They had the witnesses caught in the very act. See, I believe they did catch her. I believe that they did. But you cannot stone her without witnesses. And what happened was Christ embarrassed the witnesses. And that's the critical point here is this question, where are your accusers?
Mm-hmm. So the witnesses left of their own accord.
There were no witnesses.
So in a modern... Or we could subpoena them back,
and then they would have to come testify, right?
Put them in jail until they do, yeah. Whatever.
But in this case, there wasn't really that option, I guess. Right. So.
Plus, they brought the woman, they didn't bring the man. Okay. I mean, it was obviously...
I guess what bothers me is, how can Jesus, according to the Old Testament law, say to them, only you without guilt can throw a stone? Because according to the Old Testament law... I don't have to be guilt-free in order to see somebody in the act of adultery and throw a stone. Jesus seems to have overruled that law, in my opinion. I can't see any other way around it. And tell them, you can only throw a stone if you're innocent. Well, of course, I'm walking away to hell. I'm not totally innocent.
You probably have to take into account that Jesus was in a broader conflict with these people. And there's also part of this passage that we haven't brought up yet is that he was writing in the ground, and that plays into it because some people believe that he was writing the sentence of guilt against her. I believe it's been a long time since I've read on this, but or else writing the law against her. So that Jesus was not saying that she was innocent, but he was not going to be the instrument of carrying out justice.
Ryan, who was supposed to throw the first stone? In the traditional Hebrew setting, who was supposed to throw that first stone?
Well, what did I'm guessing the person,
the accuser.
Yeah,
right?
The accuser.
Well, it's typically the person that was transgressed against.
Really, I thought it was the witnesses.
Bringing the accusation.
Wasn't it the witnesses had to throw?
I think it was person bringing the accusation.
Person bringing the accusation.
Because if someone was murdered, obviously that person can't. You know.
Okay.
But I still can't get past the point of Jesus telling them. To me, it's a special case in the sense that is not how we normally say someone's guilty. oh, all you people out there, you can't say this person's guilty of murder if you've never sinned. We don't do that.
Yeah.
If we catch somebody in the act of murder and someone is dead, I can go up and testify and throw a stone based on the fact of what they did, not based on my merit as a guilt-free person. And I think that, to me, it's a special exception no matter what the accusers did. I think Jesus is saying something different than what we have
to do. Let's see
what
Alan.
And I just, it's always been a struggle for me. It bothered that passage.
As like John said, that they didn't bring the man, and the law said that they both would be stoned. So since the man wasn't there, they couldn't even follow out the law as prescribed.
And Jesus wasn't a civil magistrate either, so he wouldn't have been a lawful official.
Where does Matthew 7 come in about the take the plank out of your own eye before you take the splinter out of your brother's eye come in the judgment case?
I don't think he's changed the Old Testament law as far as how you treat someone who's guilty in adultery.
I would agree with that, but what I'm saying is when it comes to the sin, you without sin, he could have simply been talking about that. Go take the planks out of your eye before you come over here and accuse
him. He could, but I think you're arguing there from silence, which I know Joel has submitted that maybe all these people were caught in the exact same sin, although it doesn't say that. You're still arguing from silence. What you have written in the text, to me, does not completely jive with the Old Testament way of finding somebody guilty.
Then what are your options other than arguing from silence?
Right here. What he's saying right here. If Jesus decides I'm not going to hold you guilty, he doesn't have to.
Certainly,
because he's God. I'm saying that this makes sense to me more than any other thing I've heard.
Certainly, this is a viable option. Whether or not it's the correct one is a different subject than whether or not it is a viable. So I'm going to agree with you on it's viable. I'm not sure.
To me, that makes more sense than all the other explanations for that passage I've heard. I just as soon say, that's what Jesus decided to do. He decided to say, in this case, you're not going to judge her unless you're completely innocent. And they weren't, so they couldn't judge her. Done. End of story. That's to me, it makes the most sense.
You've been raising your hand for a while.
I'll go the whole way with this.
The whole way. There we go.
All the way in. Yeah, all in. We don't know that she was caught in the act. She could have been a person with a reputation. They say that she's caught in the act. We don't have to believe that she's caught in the act. That's the first thing. Would she have denied it? She may have. We never got to that point.
Never got there.
Yeah. We don't know that. Here's what we do know. It's interesting that it says that he wrote with his finger on the ground. This may be a lot more important than what we think. Because there was an Old Testament test for a woman accused with adultery.
Numbers.
Yep. Yep. And it was a test of gaining dust from the temple, mixing it with water, she has to drink it.
She has to drink.
If she's guilty, she has... Some people argue about whether or not what happens next, but there's some kind of physical thing that happens. It's interesting that he's in the temple, and he's clearly writing in the dust. Now, it says that they brought this so that they could accuse him. I think what's really happening here is it looks like he's on trial. What's really happening is they're the ones that are on trial. We know nothing about this woman except that Christ said, go and sin no more. I happen to think that she probably had a reputation that was really bad for him to say this. A really bad reputation. We don't know that she was caught in the act at all. We only know what they said about it. I think what might have been happening here is if we believe that Christ was really putting them on trial, which we know he did this. We know he did this with the denarius. Should we pay taxes to Caesar? He put them on trial. I think he's putting them on trial here. I think he probably is writing that law in the dirt from Numbers. Say, are you guys serious about this? Then do it. And everybody there would have known that they were not serious about the law at all. And that's why they leave with the oldest first, because that was the guy that was supposed to, if anyone, was supposed to enforce this particular law and wasn't doing it. To me, it's significant that they were in the temple, John's clear on this, and he's writing on the ground.
I remember
a long time ago I read Rush Dooney's commentary on those passages, and I don't remember what he said, but I remember being convinced. So I would recommend that anyone could go read him, and he does deal a lot with that writing on the ground. He takes that as being very significant. But again, I don't remember what he said, but I remember being convinced. So whatever that's worth.
Say the one thing we don't want to do is abandon the field with the well, this wasn't in the original manuscripts argument. Let's just,
is there supposed to doubt in the manuscripts?
Oh yeah. I read from an NAS version, the New American Standard, and mine's in brackets. It says the earliest manuscripts do not include this.
Don't you love that phrase? The earliest manuscripts do not include this, and with one phrase, it's just
whole things. Yeah, gone.
But anyway. Yes,
and also with the law, then if they brought a false accusation and it was proved that it was false, they would get the same punishment as the person who they were accusing.
Yeah.
So they would have been all stoned themselves if it was accurate.
There's an awful lot surrounding that particular story.
Yeah, that's why the earliest writers dropped it.
Brian, if you were
What, in conclusion, one of the things, if you might have noticed, is that in my argumentation here about how we understand guilt, I've relied very heavily on a particular understanding of original sin, which is that Adam's guilt was really, we are really and truly punished for Adam, what Adam did. That Adam's guilt was imputed to us. If outside of reform circles, this is violently contested. And so in our next lesson, we're going to turn to original sin, and I'm going to attempt to, first of all, prove that the guilt of his actual sin was transmitted to us, and then secondly, that was completely just on the basis of this theory. So thanks, everyone, for your attention. And have a good week.